Time now for Dr. and Mrs. Future.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Hey, Mrs. Future.
Hi, honey.
Yeah, welcome to a beautifully rainy day in Santa Cruz. Perfect time to sit around and hear some good stories.
Absolutely. I was out riding my bike this morning when it started.
That's true. You were, weren't you?
It is not the kind of rain that you need to stay inside for. It's the kind of rain you can enjoy walking around. The ground's a little wet, wear your sneakers or your tread boots, but definitely get out there and enjoy the air.
Beautiful. How's your bike riding there?
Fantastic. It was such a fun ride. I was cool, and I was riding along the ocean, and it was beautiful. It was early, so there was nobody around. Mm. It was really nice. Did you miss me?
Well, I was sleeping.
You see, I guess you didn't know.
She tends to sleep in the
early
evening.
The
sun goes down, Mrs. Future goes down.
That's right.
I wake up.
Day girl.
Yeah, this is kind of like my morning now. So I didn't miss you too much this morning when you went right on the bike. Trying to get that.
That's right. You told me you joined me in your dream. On your dream, you were bicycling.
That's right. I had a dream of bicycling in the morning in mud. I dreamt of putting my foot down. You know how when you're riding a bike and it was kind of wet, muddy ground, and I stuck my foot in it. And I remember that clearly in my morning dream. And then I remembered you were out on the bike and it was wet when we came back. So, you know, there's some sense of reality to this after all.
Mm.
Yeah. And the Jabara locker did not have any packages for us.
That's
Amazon drop-off point at Safeway.
Tomorrow.
Yes.
That's right. That was my big motivator to ride up there and get my new bike lock. Anyway, I got a good workout.
She
was the important thing.
Yeah.
Feels good.
So let's tell you a few stories today.
I'm ready.
First of all, for the second hour, we have Riz Virk on, who is a MIT professor and runner of the Play Labs. And he's going to give us the latest evidence from his new book called The Simulation Hypothesis, which is all about whether or not reality as we know it is actually just a very sophisticated simulation. Sounds a little silly in some ways, and it is. But a number of our scientists are seriously contemplating this and have some good arguments to put forth on that topic. So we'll be exploring that in the second hour.
Mm, cool. Yeah, we've had him on the show before. As I recall, last time he was exploring something that was very much about the power of positive thinking and how important it is to listen to your dreams and listen to your inspirations and your intuitive insights and really make something of those with your life. And so it's really interesting that he's taken that into a whole new context.
Yes, you know, exploring the nature of reality itself.
Yeah, right. So. Yeah. Does it listen to our thoughts? Does reality change just because we want it to?
So, did you run into any good April Fool's jokes this year or events?
Me?
Yeah.
No, it was a pretty tame April Fool's. There were a lot of weird facts that I wondered if they were April Fool's jokes, but no, in fact, it was a fairly predictable and not very funny day.
The one thing that got me that I wasn't sure it was real or not at first was a press release from Lockheed Martin that announced the release of a new fragrance that smells like space.
What
like
does
outer
that
space.
Mean?
It's a scent, an outer space scent. If you're curious, you want to wear some perfume that smells like outer space.
How does anybody know what outer space smells like? Have they taken their noses there?
Yeah, no, it has a smell to it. They say, quote, a deep metallic base with a clean, sterile feel that is balanced by a subtle yet seductive fury undertone that burns off like vapor in the atmosphere, helping men, women, and children everywhere smell like they're floating through the cosmos.
Well, that's some great copy.
I'd say.
Now, what is this again? Is this like a spritzer?
It would turn out to be an April Fool's joke, but
it was supposedly
a fragrance.
Oh,
from...
you totally got me.
Oh, there you have it. So that was a good one.
That was. That was a good description. I was going to say, they forgot to leave out the part that as you're sniffing space, that your face gets sucked out of your spacesuit.
Oh, you're so realistic, Mrs. Future.
I'm afraid so.
Oh, what do they say? Pragmatic. Yeah.
Well, let's just say that I know the difference between imagination and senses.
Yeah.
When you sense something, then I believe it has more existence in the real world than when you imagine something.
Smell makes things real. It's like emotions.
Smell is feelings, the first sense.
Emotions.
Yeah. They consider it the oldest sense.
Yeah.
It's the molecular sense. It's definitely one of the ways that we interact with the real world.
Oh, and speaking of the real world, the other thing that I think our audience might appreciate is that you did a stand-up comedy routine in public this week.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yes, she did. And we'll be posting that on our Dr. Future Show website so you can see. And she really had the audience going. You know,
a spark
I was really
of
impressed.
Joy.
Like a live audience, you know,
lots
of feedback and quips. And
I know, I was getting heckled. I handled the heckling just fine. Thank you very much. I was not expecting that. I was one of the last ones to go on and perform, and nobody else got heckled. So there must just be something about me that invites it.
Yeah, you ask for it.
I was trying to be charming.
You were. You were very charming. Her focus, folks, was bad gifts, you know.
People, no, that's your focus.
Well, that's what I heard initially.
No, my focus was a spark of joy.
A spark of joy.
Yeah, the first thing I said is you have to keep the things that spark your joy and then appreciate the things that make you happy. That was the whole talk right there.
Then where did the bad gifts come in?
That was your take on me describing sparking of joy.
Maybe the way that you dealt with the gift that I gave you. And
oh, yeah.
You turn red in public, but other than that.
Do you want to tell people the details?
No, they can watch it.
Oh,
on our website.
So you're just focused on the fact that your gift.
No, it's just
was
one of the elements.
A little bit of a challenge to spark joy.
Yeah. Can you believe? You know, anyway, I gave her a rug doctor, okay?
Yeah.
That enough said.
Enough said. Good thing you're not in the doghouse forever.
Yeah. We used it yesterday and it worked. It was really great.
It was fun. Yeah. I have to admit, I would not have thought that a rug doctor was fun, but especially once you started using it, I really enjoyed it.
You can watch it work. Almost as good as watching a robot work.
Only almost.
You get to see me do it. Yeah, it was fun.
Well,
it was fun to see those spots go away.
Flying, honey.
Yeah.
It's already been
15 minutes?
Well, we started late because of the traffic and weather and everything, but it is time for a break.
All right. We'll start with the headlines after the break.
Dr. Future. Future Tuesdays has launched. See you later.
Okay, welcome back. So in terms of strange, terrible things in space, that doesn't happen that often. Usually they're positive stories. There was an incident with India this last week where India deliberately chose to destroy a satellite in low Earth orbit with a missile. He said to blow up a satellite in low Earth
orbit.
Did
they not see the movie Gravity? What were they thinking?
The Kessler effect?
Is that what the Kessler?
Well, that's what's known as.
An exploded collision, a pile of rubble floats around the planet, like threatening anything in its path.
Well, if you blow something up with a missile, it shatters into 1,000 pieces, and each of those pieces can hit something else.
Yeah, and they
and
go
cause
out
them to explode
from the center.
Fast.
They radiate out
and cause a cascade of destruction.
Yeah. Well, apparently the Indian powers that be who authorized this felt that they were incinerating something in a low Earth orbit that would thereby get burnt up in the atmosphere as it fell. That was their logic.
NASA has found that quite a few of the pieces are above the space station.
Right. So give people an idea of the various distances involved, the heights.
Okay. The Indian satellite that was destroyed was in a low Earth orbit. It was like about 150 miles above the Earth, 185 miles to be exact, 185 miles above the Earth. And the space station is roughly 250 miles above the Earth.
So you'd think that, that's about 65 miles of difference in height.
Yeah.
Would be safe enough.
Now, the most of the particles, thousands of particles, are very small. They're less than 4 inches big. Our technology today that NASA utilizes for tracking space junk can track stuff down to about 4 inches.
Hmm.
4 inches, 10 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
So far, they're tracking about 60 pieces from the Indian space junk.
Mm-hmm.
60 pieces.
Okay.
And 24 of those 60 pieces are actually traveling above the International Space Station.
Oh, wow. So they exploded this thing and it went out past the space station.
Even though the satellite was orbiting below the space station.
Right, right. But when you explode something with a missile and it's going how many tens of thousands of miles an hour, then the impact pushes it quite a ways, especially since there's nothing out there blocking it.
Yeah, it keeps going. It doesn't slow down.
Right.
Except when it starts to enter the atmosphere.
Right.
And burns up.
Sounds like these are going the other direction. Sounds like these might hit the moon or something if they're going.
But they're saying now as much as 6,500 pieces of space junk are out there, mostly smaller than 4 inches.
Hmm.
Anyway, we'll see what happens. Hopefully nobody on board the space station will get hit. That would not be very acceptable and would be not compatible with humans in space.
It's time to invoke the force field out there at the International Space Station.
It's that easy to cause problems.
Hmm.
Jeez.
Yeah. They better make sure that the escape vehicle is ready to go just in case there's a problem, a new leak in the International Space Station.
Sure. Yeah. Backups.
Mm-hmm.
So a little further away from the Earth, well, it turns out that our astronomers have just discovered a second galaxy, a galaxy like the Milky Way, but with no dark matter. None, as far as we can tell.
Boy, now, for me, this whole area of inquiry
confusing, is
just
yeah, the dark matter,
all new.
No,
like,
okay,
I didn't even realize that dark matter was everywhere else. And so now I find out that it's novel that there's a whole galaxy that doesn't have any.
Huge surprise.
Mm-hmm.
The second one that we found. Actually, the first one was even a bigger surprise. Because as far as we can figure, dark matter is a vital part of understanding our galaxies
mm-hmm.
and how they work. Like, there's no reason why our galaxy would spin as fast as it does around the edges if it wasn't for taking dark matter into account. The mass of the galaxy would not spin the way it does by itself.
Yeah. Well, when you told me about this, I looked up dark matter, and it turns out that dark matter is, it's not visible at all. That's one of the things that makes it dark. Mm. The only way it can be detected is mathematically by looking for the gravity equation that explains how fast things are going. So once you see, say, a star or a planet or a galaxy or whatever it is that you can actually see, and then you determine its mass, then whatever isn't accounted for is called dark matter.
That's the different speed, the other way in which it moves.
It's gravity. It's actually a gravity measurement. So they've got the mass. They want to know the gravity. And that's called dark matter. Okay, so there's, so what you're telling me is they've discovered a galaxy that all of the mass is accounted for, and it's going at a speed that is predictable.
That would make
sense
within
extra
the
invisible mass for gravity.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes, the velocity is consistent with the lack of dark matter,
mm-hmm.
and because these galaxies are so peculiarly dark matter free, these two of them that they found. Now, they're actually supporting argument for its existence, that dark matter must actually exist.
It's kind of the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, because here they don't have it, and they're moving normally.
Mm-hmm.
There are alternative hypotheses to dark matter, like special exceptions to Einstein's general law of relativity and such. But they're much more difficult to explain these galaxies with no dark matter with those explanations. And so why do these galaxies not have dark matter? That is the big mystery. No one really knows. Did they have it and lose it somehow? Or did they form it without anything being injected by the nearby galaxy NGC 1052? Which is another big theory, that there's a big galaxy nearby that helped us in evolution.
Sucked up all the dark matter.
It's hard to say.
Hmm.
So anyway, they're starting to piece it together, like how do galaxies form? They want more evidence to understand what dark matter, how it behaves, you know, and this is evidence that it exists and that we need to do much further research to understand WTF.
Okay. So if there was dark matter, would this galaxy be moving even faster?
Oh, yes.
Oh, so this is a slow galaxy vis-a-vis other galaxies.
Relatively speaking, yeah. The ones with the dark matter, that's the added pep.
Got it. Got some dark matter in the fuel tank.
We got plenty of dark matter in this galaxy. We're good. And a little closer to home, let's go back into our solar system here. There's another great mystery unfolding on Mars right now, and it has to do with methane.
Methane.
Yes.
That's CH4.
Yeah, that's right. Methane gas. It periodically wafts into the atmosphere of the planet of Mars, and then it wafts out again and disappears. Hmm. And it's been confusing planetary scientists for several years now.
No kidding.
And why does it come and go away? The most exciting idea is that there might be some living microbes on Mars that are generating methane as kind of their farts, if you will.
I was going to say little teeny tiny nano farters that are putting some methane out in the very thin atmosphere of Mars.
So the ones for extraterrestrial life are all excited. Yeah, yeah, methane's finding. But there are always the Debbie Downers in the science world that say, nah, well, you can create methane just with hot water and volcanism, and that's all you need.
Well, methane is very exciting to astrophysicists because it indicates that there may be a organic decomposition, which means life. So even though it could be there for other reasons, when they find it, they start looking for life. That's what's so exciting about it.
Hey, look at this. I just got a message from Dark Matter. He says, checking up on you.
Ooh.
Better be careful here.
Ooh.
Okay, well, anyway, back to methane. Even if it turns out to be just geological and not created by life, the processes that would create methane with hot water and volcanism are the perfect places to look for life as well.
Oh, sure. That's the volcanic hot tubs, right?
Yeah.
Those are the ones that Bruce Danner is looking for. Origin of life in the lava spa.
We've been exploring Mars with Earth-based telescopes as well as data from our craft over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite an interesting story. Curiosity had detected a little bit of the gas in 2013. And then it jumps 10 times in the amount of methane in the atmosphere.
When you say 10 times, we're talking about going from maybe like one part per billion.
No, 7 parts per billion.
Uh-huh.
It's from 7 parts to 10 times that. Just move the decimal place over and what do you get?
7 parts per 100 million.
7 parts per billion. Instead of 0.7.
Okay.
Big jump.
Okay.
And then they fall back to less than 1 part per billion.
Mm-hmm.
Months of time. So that would be kind of consistent, don't you think, with spring and when it's warmer, you create more life and so more methane forms and that would be detectable.
We think so.
Yeah.
Well, carbon and hydrogen, those are elements that tell us a lot about what's on the planet and hopefully some of it's alive, right?
Hopefully. And remember, Gale's Crater.
What's on Gale's Crater?
That's where the methane is being detected, that area.
Oh, so maybe we're going to
maybe we'll discover life on Mars near Gale's Crater.
Send a probe up there and smell the flowers.
Yeah, that's the current evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. This is going fast today.
Yeah,
it's already
time for the news, eh?
Time.
All right. Well, got plenty more stories for you. And we have something that's going to change the way you eat. The next segment too. Very much a very, very interesting new breakthrough that's going to be available everywhere.
Dr. Future, we'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Earth again. And I think we'll do an Earth story for the next one.
Okay.
All right.
Got my gravity boots on.
I saw this in the New York Times. Thank you, Richard, for forwarding this to me. Behold the beefless impossible Whopper. So it looks like Burger King is introducing a Whopper. And we've done commercials on Whoppers. Remember for Dr. Fusion?
Oh, yes.
Yes, famous Whopper commercial.
Tracking the Whoppers around here.
So this is a little synchronistic here. Made with a vegetarian patty from the startup Impossible Foods here in the Bay Area. The Impossible Foods Burger. There's a whole story behind it, but basically a Stanford professor and his network have created a burger that hamburger lovers can't tell that it's vegetarian. It's based on plant food. It tastes like real meat.
The double blind sniff test.
It tastes like real meat. They did some mm-hmm. real scientific mumbo jumbo to make it so.
Okay, so the Impossible Burger is going to be available at the
Burger King's.
Burger King's, mm-hmm. Land of the Whopper.
Yeah, 7,500.
You can get it your way.
That's right. The Impossible Whopper, it'll be known as.
The Impossible Whopper. Okay.
And it's a company that's been making inroads into the main burger companies. Impossible Foods and its competitors in Silicon Valley have already gotten into, like, Carl's Jr. There's a company called Beyond Meat that is now at over 1,000 Carl's Jr. restaurants. And they're going towards an initial public offering soon. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is a growing part of the market, the new type of food that's coming down. White Castle. White Castle has sold a slider version of the Impossible Burger in about 380 or so stores since late last year. But this is going to be a national rollout at Burger King, 7,200 locations. It'll dwarf all previous announcements.
All right, so these are basically veggie burgers. They're fake burgers made of vegetables that people can simulate their burger habit but feel good about not harming cows.
Yeah, and a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere and methane and other galaxies.
Oh, it creates less methane,
come from
huh?
all these millions of cows that we kill every year for food.
I see. Uh-huh.
You see,
so,
and eat.
Greenhouse gases will be a little more tameable if we can eat the Impossible
Burger. So if you
Methane minimization burger.
And if you don't have to put up with a difference in taste or texture, then why not make the switch? It has protein in it as well. Mm-hmm. It satisfies your cravings for beef. As far as your brain is concerned or your body's concerned,
if
you're
taste
eating beef.
Is the only issue.
No, cravings. Right. It's not just about taste. It's about uh-huh. your cravings.
What are they made of? What are they made of, if not animals?
You want to know what the secret sauce is? Well,
sure.
Several companies are chasing various ways of imitating meat. Beyond Meat bases its products on pea protein and beet juice.
So peas and beets.
Yeah, and the beet
tastes just
beet
like boigas.
Gives it that bloody look.
That's right. Beets make it red. Yeah. Peas make it protein. Okay.
Now, impossible. Now, what's impossible?
And when you put the green and red together, it makes it brown.
Ooh, yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm getting
looking
it.
Looking real now.
Uh-huh.
And then Impossible's big innovation comes from its use of what's known as heme. H-E-M-E.
Heme.
It's an iron.
Sounds like hemoglobin.
That's right. That's right, Mrs. Future. It's an iron-rich protein that the company believes is responsible for much of the distinctive taste of meat.
Hmm. Okay.
They cultivate heme from the roots of soybean plants, and they mass produce it using yeast.
I see. So I can just imagine that all of the vegetarian world is going to now switch over to not wanting to eat plants. You know, like we don't want to harm any
plants. Have feelings too.
That's right. We don't want
they
to
do.
Harm the plants.
I know, but they like to be eaten too. Curious
that's
enough.
What I think. I think yes. we're on what
they don't have a. They don't
one
have
of my
a,
favorite
big
teachers,
a hang up about it.
Yogananda way, so. Says that we may as well get used to the idea that we are on predator planet, and no matter what our level of spiritual growth and awareness is, we have to make peace with our bodies on this planet where the food chain has evolved and we're in it. We're on it.
Well, the Impossible Burger has gotten a number of environmentalists upset.
Oh,
already.
Why? What happened?
Well, because they tested out their Impossible Burgers on rats.
Oh, really?
Did mice.
Did the rats and they mice liked like
yeah, they
them?
Wanted to see if they would eat them as much as they are. Yeah, they were doing tests along those lines.
Well, that doesn't sound very offensive.
Well, it,
I mean, they're feeding
a small
them. They're not harming
of
them.
Environmentalists that are into that. That's, yeah, and the cattle ranchers.
Oh, cattle ranchers.
Because they don't want it to be called meat.
Oh, what would they like it to be called? Heat? Heme? We'll call it heme.
Fake meat, I think it'd be called.
Yeah.
Terrible tasting.
Pay
or something
an extra
like that.
Buck and you'll get some fake
one
meat.
One bite of terrible meat and you'll love it.
Well, this
no,
is
that's,
nothing new, really. Yeah. They've been doing soy-based meat products for quite a long time.
Yes.
So the big breakthrough here is that they're coloring them red with beets?
No, that they actually are being rolled out to Burger King locations nationwide. It's a huge rollout. Mm-hmm. That's the really big news on this. Okay. I mean, they've been evolving these for a while. Okay. And, you know, coming up behind all these front runners are, of course, are the new companies that are going to be using stem cells of real beef to create burgers without killing any animals.
Right. And that's going to be the real...
That's a little more complicated than using pure plant-based product. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, coming down the tubes here.
Right. Okay. Where the nanoparticles of protein meet the beings who love their own cells.
Yeah. We'll just get to the point where you can eat all these fake meats and enjoy them, and then we'll modify our so that we wouldn't eat them anyway.
What do you mean? What are we going to eat instead? We're going to start inhaling pollen.
Yeah, and well, no one see, will I don't ever it's just eat a meat. Ever. Scenario I see on spooling in my mind here, where if we all are no longer eating meat, then it's kind of like an anchor that is loosed, and your boat is free to begin to cruise into other forms of molecular ingestion. You know, and other forms of food that you might try. Anyway, it's a.
I'm having trouble following that thread.
It's okay. It's all right. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Let's move on, shall we?
Sure.
It's an impossible thought.
It's an impossible thought about impossible burgers.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. The other element here in terms of the body, besides the food element, is the piece on Live Science this week about a woman who doesn't feel pain.
Wow, that sounds like a possibly desirable, although if she doesn't feel pain, maybe she doesn't feel pleasure either.
Well, hopefully not that this...
Nobody asked her that.
Yeah,
huh?
I didn't see anything in the article about pleasure here. That's true, is this future? I don't know what's going on here. Hmm. It says, imagine smelling your flesh burning before feeling it. No, I don't want to do that. A 71-year-old...
Sounds gross.
71-year-old woman in Scotland lived her entire life like that. Not only not feeling the pain of burns, but any pain at all.
She just didn't know that
just didn't
wasn't
feel pain.
Usual? Yeah. Did she find out that other people felt pain and she wondered what it was?
It wasn't until she was fairly old and she had hand surgery and she reported feeling no pain before or after the procedure. And she had told doctors that she had osteoarthritis in her hips and they scanned her and they had severely degenerated joints. And yet she felt no pain. I said, holy moly, Mrs. Bill, what's going on with her? So researchers at the University College London, University of Oxford, carried out genetic tests to see what could be driving her pain insensitivity. And so a big report came out in the Journal of Anesthesia about this last week, that her rare insensitivity to pain is caused by a mutation in a gene that previously we thought was useless. Mm-hmm. We didn't see any point to it. And then... You know, it turns out it affects pain sensitivity. One mutation was a tiny deletion in a not well-documented pseudogene, a segment of DNA that is thought of as a non-functional copy of a parent gene called FAAH.
FAAH.
F-A-A-H.
This sounds like a little bit of a joke. FAAH. She doesn't feel pain. FAAH. Okay.
The second was a mutation in the original gene, which was just called FAAH. So you get FAAH and FAAH out. And they're not unique just to this woman in Scotland. What's unique in her case is the tiny portion that's deleted from the pseudogene.
Do tell.
Yeah. Group in Canada, University of Calgary, studied it further, and they analyzed her blood, and they found that she had high blood levels of compounds that are typically broken down by the FAAH protein, such as anandamide, which is usually used to reduce anxiety and pain. Naturally higher levels in her blood. So you might say, well...
So she doesn't feel pain, she doesn't feel anxiety, she's just a happy camper all the time.
Yes. The pleasure thing is an interesting question, Mrs. Future. I don't know what they would say about that. They're looking at how this FAAH pseudogene can be used for reducing pain in others. You know, so if she can do it, can we do it? She also seems to heal very quickly in her wound healing, which is a very interesting thing, especially after surgery. So they're looking at maybe these genes can help us with faster recovery periods.
Well, it is fascinating because pain management, I think, is one of the big frontiers in medicine, right? That's why we have so many difficulties with addiction, because there's so many people getting prescriptions trying to relieve pain. So maybe there's a new approach that could alleviate people of their suffering.
Yes, that we can play with pain sensitivities.
Right.
Adjust that dial.
And I know when I have a backache or something like that, that first thing I have to do is take an aspirin and get rid of the pain, and then it can relax and get better. Right?
It's a big thing, I know.
Yeah, because it's like your body responds to the pain itself and just holds on to it.
Yeah.
And doesn't let it go.
So. Yeah, this kind of weather that we're having right now with the wetness can bring out a little arthritis in joints and stuff like that. And, coming up with more and interesting, better ways of dealing with this, I'm all for.
All right.
Yeah, so.
Very interesting.
Do I want to modify my genes for it, though? That's the question.
Would modifying your genes help? Apparently, this woman is born with this quality.
Yeah, that's true. We're early on here.
All right, we'll be back. Well, I guess I forgot to put some music at the end.
Were you reading something, Mrs. Future?
Well, I was just waiting for the music to cue. Yeah.
I see the music auto comes on, cues you up.
That's right. It wakes me up. It's like, okay, we are back.
So two more stories I want to get in before our guest arrives.
I'm ready
First,
for
you. First is a piece I was reading in AccuWeather about the weather on Neptune.
The weather on Neptune.
Yeah, curious weather report on Neptune.
Do you think Siri can tell you about that, or Alexa? Do
Maybe.
You ever ask them?
No, I should.
Weather on
question.
Neptune.
Yeah. Yeah, well, apparently Neptune has these giant storms that are, you know, you see on Jupiter, the giant red spot.
I bet an umbrella would not help.
Yeah. Well, our first probe went by Neptune, Voyager 2.
Mm, wow. Mm-hmm.
Neptune had this great dark spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always think of Neptune as this single color planet. It's the simplest of all the planets.
Bluish greenish kind of
thing. Yeah, it's just a big blue gas ball.
Well, imagine, if you will, it has this giant dark spot on it.
Mm-hmm.
That we've known since the Voyagers in 89.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was when we found it. Yeah, Neptune in 89. It was the final planetary target before our probe took off for the outer
heliosphere.
Heliosphere, the atmosphere of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now is outside of our solar system entirely, the first craft to really do that.
Yeah.
So the great dark spot. And then after that, we had some information coming from the Hubble that showed that there was a second dark spot.
Oh, all right.
And it was huge. The great dark spot was 8,000 by 4,000 miles in size.
Wow.
I mean, that's enough to drop the Earth.
That's the diameter of the Earth.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Hubble in 1994. It took sharp pictures of Neptune, and it revealed that the Earth-sized great dark spot was there, and that the first one had vanished. So it showed that there were like storms. These were like temporary spots. They would appear and go away, but they were storms that had lasted for a few years.
Wow.
Compared to Earth storms, which, you know, last a few days.
Yeah, or storms on Jupiter, which appear to last centuries.
Right, as Jupiter's great spot has been going on since the 1830s.
Right.
So this is a little faster than that. 1830, the great stuff. So we have an outer planet atmosphere's legacy group, an OPAL group. They call it OPAL, and they study images from Hubble, and they've been analyzing these pictures to look at the storms of Neptune. So I have a nice article in our drfutureshow.com/links page about the storms of Neptune.
So first they looked at a current Hubble picture and they saw the dark spots, and then they assembled all of the historic shots.
And they go back with the Hubble every year to see what's going on with the storms, and then they were able to see them appear and go away.
Mm-hmm.
They have one now that's a smaller storm from 2015, and then a large storm appeared really soon after that. They weren't expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
Pleasant surprise to catch a giant storm on the cameras. Our scientists were ecstatic about that. Then they started analyzing, well, how does weather form on Neptune? And one of the most interesting things about that was that before a storm happens, these small white clouds form where the storm is going to be. And that's the first sign. You see these small white clouds.
Oh, maybe there's some cold space leaking into the atmosphere, as you were proposing last week.
Right? Maybe. Yeah, the Neptunians from deep in the core.
Right. The Neptunians are trying to inhale some of the vacuum to cool down their planet.
Yeah. So it appears as white little clouds, and then it turns dark and becomes the storm.
Hmm. All right.
So that's what we've learned.
Sounds pretty ominous.
So studying the weather on Neptune and the OPAL group, that's what they love to do. You can keep track of their work. Every year they get a new picture to analyze.
Wow.
Yeah, Hubble goes over there and helps update the program all the time.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And so in preparation for the simulation hypothesis, I'm going to talk about the zoo hypothesis. The zoo hypothesis explains why we haven't seen any other intelligences in the universe, no other space aliens or ETs or anything, why we haven't actually run into them, at least in terms of mainstream awareness or news.
Oh, so you have an explanation for that, huh?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like having an explanation for the car accident that you didn't have.
Well, why don't we see any? Well, Seth Shustak is one of the great guys in the Valley here who talks about the future and is very interested in contacting ET in various ways.
Mm-hmm. You know, they,
he's one of the guys, and he puts out,
there.
And you'll see how this ties in later. He says that maybe we're just like kids in the universe, and there's a big sign on our planet that basically says, caution, children at play. And we're essentially left alone, and we're kind of a zoo planet, mm-hmm. You know, where if you want to watch us, you can, but we're not to be touched.
Okay.
Not to be mucked with.
Well, this is big theme in sci-fi. Everything from 2001 Space Odyssey, where...
The Prime Directive in Star Trek.
And the Prime Directive in Star Trek, right. But somehow we've got a race of space aliens that we don't know about that are looking at us, and we're just animals in a zoo. That's the zoo hypothesis.
And we don't know we're in a zoo.
We don't know we're in a zoo.
Yeah, we don't know. We have no clue. Mm-hmm. That this is a zoo, or what Alex Jones calls it, prison planet, but no, the zoo is probably nicer.
So we think of it as a free will universe.
A place to be.
Deluded.
All those questions, all those monkey philosophy questions are relatively limited to understanding based on what we've picked up by being on one planet for a few thousand years, and that's it. So that kind of mentality might be very primitive to anyone that's been around for millions of years, right, okay. In terms of their consciousness. So the aliens would be much smarter than us, mm-hmm. And which means that they would probably not mess around. We're kind of like, we're like a protected species on this planet. We protect the eel, you know, the freshwater eel.
Are we like the white tigers?
We're the white tigers. Maybe we're a little better. Yeah, and it'll kind of keep them there, and hopefully they won't blow it up.
They're just hoping that we don't accidentally gnaw them during a show sometime, tigers.
Hopefully not. I'm not saying this is necessarily true. This is called the zoo hypothesis, right? And it also explains Fermi's paradox.
Fermi's paradox.
It's a long-standing puzzle. It was brought up about 7 years ago by the physicist Enrico Fermi, and it rests on the fact that the universe is very old, so... Consequently, if intelligent life is commonplace, then some of it is surely advanced enough to have colonized the entire galaxy, probably a while ago. And then we should see, therefore, evidence of aliens everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we don't is explained by the fact that we're being deliberately isolated.
Mm. Like deliberately isolated.
Yeah, that we're a zoo.
Because there's light years of space between us and the next nearest star. That sounds pretty deliberate.
Well, there's that too, and not knowing enough about the universe to be able to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that where star distances are a problem for us. That is a form of keeping us in the dark.
Uh-huh. Literally.
Literally, yes. And it depends on which stories you listen to. What's your narrative? I mean, my narrative is more mainstream science with this. But I love science fiction. I also like the quasi-fiction stuff, like the idea of a secret space program.
All right, so who is responsible for this zoo hypothesis and this idea that the space aliens can see us, but we can't see them? That just sounds like pure fiction to me.
Well, the zoo hypothesis has been around for a while. I don't know if any one group can really claim credit for it. It's been in the news recently because it provides justification for an activity known as METI, M-E-T-I, Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Uh-huh.
People who do that transmit radio signals and hope that they'll provoke a response from any aliens who might pick it up.
So is there an app for that? Is there an alien texting app?
Like, there was a Norwegian antenna used for beaming a message to a star system 12 light years away in 2017.
Oh, so we were aiming for a particular star system where you thought
It's like independent groups. They think, oh yes, I have channeled information that my consciousness must connect with Alpha Ceti 3. Uh-huh. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to do it through meditation, or I'm going to do it through building a radio antenna. Mm-hmm. Our species tries all kinds of ways of contacting other intelligences.
Right. Well, this... is interesting in the light of the piece that we listened to last night from Linda Moulton Howe, who in her construction of her research, she believes that we found all kinds of alien artifacts right here on this planet.
Yes, that's another big controversy, because some people say, look, there's evidence all over the place of alien stuff, and other people say, well, no, that's not real evidence.
And people are just keeping it secret not putting it out to the mass public.
Right, that it's kept secret.
And so we're kind of in a time where we have so much more information than ever before in history, so many more facts, but we don't know which of them are credible and which of them are made up. So there's a lot more permission to just think whatever you want, because there's a lot less conformity to whether people believe it or not.
Yeah, it's much more free-for-all in some respects.
Well, back to the idea of a free will universe.
Yeah, or to further confuse it, in the next hour we'll be talking about how the whole thing might just be a simulation to begin with, and who would give us in such a confusing simulation in the first place, and furthermore, why?
Furthermore, why? Well, we're here at the last minute of the first hour, and then do you want to say something about our guest, Riz?
Yeah, we hope he's on the air. We hope he's real. And if not, we'll talk about it anyway.
Oh, he may be a simulation?
Yeah, he might.
Think?
Well, he, yeah. You
I
never
think
know. He might be an AI.
We connected to the real Riz.
He is involved
Virk
with
before.
MIT. He's introduced to us through the Play Labs. And, you know, there's a few possibilities that he might be something else. Anyway,
when
we'll
do we know that you're not a simulation?
You decide. What evidence do you
me?
Need, Mrs. Future? No, not necessarily.
You seem pretty real to me.
I think I'm pretty real,
but
yeah.
You sure are fascinated
I'm
with
I'm trying
you.
To, you know, share a few thoughts here. We're curious
right.
What you think.
Dr. Future here on KSEO Santa Cruz.